You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 27th of November, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index, with a review of the past fortnight's construction industry news. And I should say, any listeners who wonder about the sound quality of this particular episode of the podcast, it's not your device, it's mine. Something's happened with my microphone. It doesn't appear to be working particularly well, so we're having to struggle through using whatever technology we can.
Morning, David. You're struggling. I'm not. I think mine's all working, touch wood.
Well, I'll let you do most of the talking then, Phil. But yeah, it's been a busy couple of weeks, hasn't it? There's been quite a lot going on.
We could be in for a bumper episode this morning if we if we're feeling loquacious. and quite a few statistics to get our heads around, which I think I'm keener on stats than you are in general.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think the old cliche, lies, damn lies of statistics, will raise its head. But, I mean, the big story this morning, before, I don't want to talk at length about this, but just as a sort of a crudité, a precursor to the meal, the news broke yesterday afternoon that the Trade Remedies Authority, this new arm of government, which is sort of polices post-Brexit trade disputes, which was created in 2021, they are recommending that fairly hefty tariffs are added to excavators imported from China. Now, there's a lot in the papers the past few days about Donald Trump, when he becomes president, imposing tariffs on Mexico and Canada and everywhere. None of the national papers seem particularly interested in this story, but for the construction industry, I think it's a big deal.
Yeah, definitely.
The headline is 83.5% tariffs, but that's going to be for only a few. And the big ones that we have seen the most of in this country cooperated with the inquiry. For some reason, by cooperating with the inquiry, they get the proposal, which the minister now has to sign off at some point in the future. I don't know how long that's going to take. But the proposal is that Sarnie, their excavators will have a tariff of 33%, 33.03. I don't know how they arrive at these figures.
No.
But there's a big document you can plough through, and there's a link from our site, and you can find it. Sarnie, roughly 33%. XCMG, 56%. And Liugong, 59%. And all the others, 83.5%. So it's still pretty hefty. So the idea of Chinese excavators being the cheap option looks like, if this happens, that's out of the window. And it's hard to see. I mean, I reckon the only reason why people would buy a Chinese excavator now is based on the price.
Yes.
I mean, when we first saw Japanese excavators, same with Japanese cars, when they first arrived, it was like, ooh, they're really, really good, really, really reliable. You'd buy them, it'd be a quality purchase. When the Koreans came, they were as good, but cheaper, and you might get more whistles and bells as standard rather than as extras. So the Koreans did well. The Chinese, I mean, they're probably pretty much now as good, broadly speaking. I mean, I don't think they're particularly a premium product, but there's nothing wrong with them. They work. The hesitation, I think, for a lot of buyers in recent years has been whether there's the customer support, whether you'd be able to get the parts, what the resale value is going to be is a big issue. But for some buyers, the resale value is less important than the upfront price, and that's appealing. Now, quite what's going to happen with these Chinese importers now? Don't know.
No.
If this happens,
no, interesting. I mean, if you look at any sort of consumer goods bought over the counter these days, chances are it's made in China or it uses components that are made in China. We're quite used to buying Chinese products. Even if you look at your phone, I've got an American phone apparently, but it's not, it's made in China. Chinese products are probably just as good as Japanese, Korean or American products, generally speaking. I mean, maybe you can't generalize, but I should think most of us are happy to buy a Chinese product. were it not for the fact that we don't really want to subsidize Xi Jinping. And, there are the whole sort of geopolitical questions about Chinese production, like the Uyghurs being used as slave labor in the west of the country, things like that. That's probably the only reason that most people would think twice about buying a Chinese product. But I don't think quality is an issue anymore.
But the product support is still, I think, a concern for major purchases like an excavator or a piece of construction machinery. I think that is, I mean, they've got some good dealers, but they haven't got the dealers with the depth and the breadth of other well-known brands, more established brands.
Well, it'd be worth watching this because they have done extremely well. I mean, there's an interesting graph that you ran with the story, which shows the market share by volume of British manufacturers compared to those from the People's Republic of China. And since, over the past 4 years, market share of domestic manufacturers has been very gradually declining. But there's been a massive surge in the market share of Chinese imports until they're almost as much as the domestic manufacturers. And it looks as if within the next couple of years or so.
Well, the graph only goes up to June 2023, so they may have crossed over already.
Well, they might have done. That's a good point. Yes, it only goes up to last year. So, yeah, definitely you can see why the TRA has done something about this. It's clearly of concern to certain well-known British manufacturers who alerted the TRA, I understand.
Well, it's JCB. JCB exactly. filed a complaint and said, what are you going to do? Anyway, that's not our main topic. First thing I wanted to talk about is the subject of apprentices, specifically fast-tracking apprentices. There was a press release published on the Department for Education led this, 22nd of November. They put out a release saying 5,000 more construction apprenticeship places will be made available per year thanks to a £140 million industry investment to get Britain building again. That sounds fantastic, except this is not... It's industry investment, so it's not government money. The government aren't doing anything here. And the very last paragraph says up to 5,000. So it may not be 5,000 at all. What, I hope our report fleshed out, what's going on here is that the National House Building Council has allocated £100 million to opening 12 more construction training centres over the next 4 years. They already have, I've got it somewhere here. They've got, I think, four training centres. Yes, NHBC has got four training centres already. And they're planning on opening 12 more. While the CITB and the government press release made it sound like the CITB was opening training centres. It's not. CITB out of direct delivery of training. CITB doesn't do training. There are two national colleges which have... one in Scotland, one in Kent, which have CITB stamp of approval on them. And they're hoping that with their 40 million, they'll be able to get another 20 colleges. We've got 100 million for 12 NHBC training centres and 40 million for 20 CITB-approved training centres over the next 5 years. And all of this depends on whether it happens or not, is whether young people go, yes, please, I want to be an apprentice. And employers go, yes, we want to take on apprentices. So it's entirely up to the employers and the young people. This is not something the government can say, here's a training centre, if you build it, they will come. No, they've got to come first. So it's not as rah-rah-rah as you might think.
I mean, 5,000... apprentices sounds like a lot, but
you're just touching on my second talking point. Yeah, go on.
Okay, sorry, I was gonna pushing in front of you there. Go on, Phil, take it away.
Well, no, as we ran in our story, over the past 5 years, 350,000 people have left the construction industry, which is an average of 70, 75,000 a year. So an additional five, we've already got roughly 25,000 apprentices a year, but a dropout rate of nearly 50%. So let's say there are 13, 14,000 apprentices each year qualify. Add 5,000, assuming there's no dropout from the extra 5,000, you're looking at less than 20,000, however you cut it, replacing 75,000. So it doesn't go far enough. I mean, we need, I mean, obviously there are other ways into the construction industry than via an apprenticeship, but it doesn't go far enough at all.
No. I mean, what's the alternative? I mean, if you want new people to come into the industry and you need to train them, all you can do is offer them places on apprenticeships. There's really no other alternative, except presumably try and encourage people to come in from outside the UK, people who are already qualified. You know, and we all know about sort of migrant labour. It's been very important to the construction industry in the past. Presumably the government isn't encouraging that.
Well, that will be a lobbying point. And I think the construction industry has been lobbying for, you know, migrant labour to be allowed.
I've had emails, press releases recently from organisations who offer training courses for employers, basically training them in the methods required and the systems surrounding the employment of migrant labour. So there's clearly an interest there. The industry.
Oh, and it is there. I don't know the stats, but there is still migrant labour coming in. But anyway, so the numbers is the second point. The third point, and what I think is a really interesting point here, is that partly to plug the gap as much as they can, as quickly as they can, and partly to do something about this wretched 47% dropout rate, which is huge.
It is. Isn't it?
They are the NHBC and CITB, of course, they're proposing fast tracking. So you'll be able to get you'll become a qualified, you know, plasterer, bricklayer, plumber, whatever. Instead of in 2 to 3 years, it will be in a year to 18 months, something like that. So half the time. And you kind of can't help thinking, will the quality, is someone who's trained for 18 months going to be as competent, as qualified as someone who's trained for 3 years? And then I think back to, okay, my degree was not at all practically useful. I have a degree in politics, which is teaches you how to write an essay, I suppose, and that's about it. But I, you know, had to learn how to wire a plug in my own time. And that took me 3 years. And I know I could have done that, you know, in 18 months quite easily if I'd, you know, not spent 12 hours a day in bed and 6 hours a day in the bar and 5 hours a day on the playing fields. Now, that's not the case, I know, for engineering students and a lot of people who do proper courses. They are in lecture halls, you know, 5 days a week and working hard. But certainly my degree course could have been done a lot quicker. So maybe we have been, you know, construction apprentices, we have been giving them too much time off and we can make them sweat and work harder and get it done quicker. I did ask CITB about whether fast tracking, you know, how they were going to fast track and still have the same output, quality of output. And this is what they say, quote, there are a number of construction apprenticeship providers in England who already deliver apprenticeship standards more quickly than the normal expected duration. Tried and tested ways of doing this include ensuring better links between workplace mentoring and the training standard, block release delivery, and better management of endpoint assessments and endpoint assessment preparation, which mean an apprentice is well prepared and not waiting unqualified when they are ready to go.
I'm not sure what all that means, but basically being more efficient.
They do say the fast track route won't be right for every candidate. Some apprentices do need longer to complete and build up confidence and skills, but not everyone does. That makes sense, I guess. If we had, you know, brainy kids at school who jumped a year, who pushed straight up a year. So yeah, there are, you know, people who can do that. But
yeah, but I think with a lot of sort of manual trades like bricklaying and plastering and stuff like that, It's really the hours spent actually practicing it. It's not so much a theory, is it? You've got to actually put in the hours on site, or, you know, the practical skills are the things which take time to acquire. You can't just sort of say, right, this is how you do it, and then expect them to go out and, you know, plaster a wall perfectly smooth or lay bricks perfectly evenly.
But if there's a certain test they have to pass and they can pass it after 15 months, let them. Don't have to, you know, why keep them in school for another 6 months when they can already pass the test?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know that some universities were talking, I haven't heard about it recently, but certainly some universities were talking about scrapping 3-year degree courses and going to 2 years. Whether or not that
Yes, that's because of the fees, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So that makes sense. But possibly there was the same amount of tuition. They just didn't have massively long holidays in the summer. I don't really know how that was going to work, but maybe it is possible to fast track these courses without actually compromising quality.
I haven't heard anything about 2-year degree courses for ages, though. It was quite a talking point when tuition fees first came in and student loans and all of that. I don't know if any of them offer it. Did any of your offspring, your brood, did they look at those sort of courses? Did they see anything like that?
No, they didn't. No, they all did 3-year courses. I don't think there was a 2-year option. If there was, I wasn't aware of it. You know, I think the apprenticeship, because of you mentioned the university fees, that I think has actually encouraged a lot of people who would have gone to university and done an academic course to actually go and do like a degree apprenticeship. They've become far more popular now. And I think they're actually really good, because not only does the student earn money while they're studying, but they get the qualification, they get a degree at the end of it. And, you know, they're not saddled with a massive debt at the end of the course. So I would have thought that certainly degree apprenticeships were very attractive to people who might have just gone to university instead.
They're still tiny, though. I agree with you, they're a great thing, but hardly anyone's doing them.
Why is that?
Partly it's lack of awareness, and I think there's still some parents, particularly rather than young people, sort of thinking, oh, that's not a proper university degree, is it? It's...
Well, when you look at some of the degrees that kids go on to do, I don't know, the classic ones are media studies and, I don't know,
golf ball awareness.
Surfing theory and stuff like that. It does make you wonder what the value of... I mean, we're on this topic of Mickey Mouse degrees again. We shouldn't dwell on that. Everybody knows that there are degree courses out there which really don't prepare people for the world of work. So I think...
Including mine.
And mine indeed. So here we are, Phil. This is what we're qualified to do.
Right, should we move on to the next topic, which has also got a lot of statistics involved. We also had published the HSE, Health and Safety Executive, published their annual data for the year to beginning of April 2024. They always do sort of financial years, HSE, rather than calendar years. And there's lots to get your teeth into on this. There's nothing we didn't know. We know today's statistics show what we've always known, that lots of people get injured on construction sites. Most common causes are falls from height, slips and trips, hit by a moving vehicle, collision with a moving vehicle. They are the classic big dangers.
Yeah.
But what I found particularly interesting when I was going through it, thinking, I knew that safety was only half the story. We tend to now talk about construction site accidents, but actually occupational health has become more and more a hot topic, and is more and more, let's leave aside the whole mental health topic, which is also a big one, but physical occupational health. And there are more people getting ill health at work, according to the HSE statistics, than injured. So here are the figures. 47,000 construction workers a year sustain an injury at work. That's the average of the past 3 years. 47,000 a year get injured to some degree or another, reportable injury. 78,000 are suffering from work-related ill health, either new or long-standing.
Right.
Now, of course, injuries you tend to recover from, and therefore that's there, whereas ill health can be open-ended. It can be indefinite. And so you're thinking, actually, you're more likely to get sick working on a construction site than injured. And you think, that's a fascinating statistic.
Yeah.
Except that of that 78,000 people who get ill or are ill each year, 52% are due to musculoskeletal disorders.
Like what? Vibration?
I.e. probably a result of manual handling. I don't know. Is vibration white finger musculoskeletal? It sort of is. I'm not sure whether that's classified. But certainly a knackered back from, you know, lifting too much or in the wrong way or whatever. And I question whether, I mean, obviously, you know, you get a sick note if you've got a musculoskeletal disorder, but I question whether we should be calling that in the statistics an illness. I mean, to me, a knackered back is an injury.
Yeah. I think the only thing that defines ill health is that it's sort of long term. It's sort of chronic rather than acute. I mean, obviously, if you smack your finger with a hammer, or you drop a concrete block on your foot, that's an injury. And as you say, a couple of weeks off work and you've recovered well enough to get back to work. But if you've got, you know, if you're lifting heavy loads and lifting them badly, eventually you'll get a bad back, and that bad back will stay with you for a long time. So it's like sort of chronic injuries are classified as illnesses, whereas acute injuries are classified as injuries. That's the only way I can really understand that.
Yeah, I mean, there may be statistical reason that a long-term injury is, for statistical analysis, it helps. It's helpful to put it in with illness because that's intended to be sort of a longer-term, open-ended thing. But, you know, and if a footballer retires early because they can't get over their, you know, cruciate ligament injury or whatever, you don't say, oh, they got sick. They retired at 25 because he got sick. You go, no, you had an injury that he couldn't recover from.
Yeah. Well, obviously, one of the most notorious construction industry health issues is asbestos exposure. You know, if somebody becomes ill, they get asbestosis or mesothelioma or any of the other diseases which are caused by asbestos, that's an illness. It's not an injury.
Clearly, you weren't
injured. You weren't injured by the asbestos. It caused an illness. Whereas a bad back or aching joints, stuff like that, mainly wear and tear and problems associated with long-term exposure. Well, yes, premature wear and tear. Yeah, we all suffer it in the long term. Yeah, I think it's rather strange. Also, I found in this report, one of the interesting things was a comparison with some other sectors of the economy. Public sector workers seem to be the most likely to be signed off sick. And, you know, the people working in health and social care, 6%, I think, in the last year were signed off sick, compared to only 3.8% in construction. So, you know, what's going on there? You know, is construction a healthier environment than a hospital?
Well, probably. I mean, the last place you want to go when you're ill is hospitals. You always catch something there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're certainly likely to encounter more sick people in a hospital, but that's just a smokescreen. I don't know.
We were talking about this yesterday. There's a tendency for construction workers are more likely to be self-employed than in other industries. And so the tendency of, if you're feeling a bit under the weather, you'd be reluctant to sign off sick because you're not going to get paid often. You know, you want to be at work and earning.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's interesting that the rate for people signing off sick in construction is about the same as in, as I said in the piece, in arts and entertainment, where, you know, the famous of the show must go on. And
yes.
You often hear, you know, particularly stage actors who are, if they don't turn up, if they sign off sick, the understudy's going to go on and do a stormer, and they're going to replace you, and you might never work again.
Your career's over. Yeah.
And Graham Norton stood in once for, I can't remember, Jack, someone or other, who never to be seen of again. He stood in once for him on a chat show, and suddenly Graham Norton's been prime time Saturday night for, you know, 20 years, and the other guy's barely heard of since.
Yeah, well, that doesn't happen in construction, at least not as far as I'm aware. No, it's very strange. I mean, self-reported injuries was another thing that they reported on. And the incidence of self-reported injuries in construction seems to be around 2.4%, compared to 1.8% in health and social work. So, you know, people, I think you're encouraged, aren't you, on a construction site, if there's any incident, you know, if you do hit your thumb with a hammer, you're expected to report that. Doesn't mean you actually go home. You know, you just put a plaster on it and go back out to work again.
And it says construction sites, we famously say construction is the most dangerous. Well, it's not, because there's more people that actually, you know, fishing off sea and agriculture,
yes, exactly,
and fishes and forestry,
and farming,
are generally more dangerous. But in terms of self-supported industries, self-supporting injuries, the HSE stats show that you're safer on a construction site than you are in a kitchen.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's quite a telling statistic. I don't know. I certainly would be very careful. I mean, I haven't been on a construction site for an awfully long time, but I would certainly watch myself when I was on the construction site, because there is a lot going on. And as you say, there are big machines working around you, and there are potential trips and hazards like that, and things you can fall into and fall off of. I wouldn't go onto a construction site and say, oh, it's pretty safe here, I can lower my guard. You don't do that. You might do that in a hospital, or, you know, or even in a restaurant. You might think that you're in a safer environment.
I don't know. You'd thought kitchen workers would be, you know, they know how sharp the knife is.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, and there's hot stuff and there's sharp stuff.
Anyway, should we move on? Anything else to say about the HSE statistics?
I don't think so. I mean, it's worth looking into them. But as you said at the outset, you know, it's a case of, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics. You can cut the stats various different ways, can't you? And these are the bare figures, I suppose. And it's up to the reader to interpret them.
The one thing that always slightly frustrates me when I've tried to drill down the HSE statistics before. For example, the being struck by a moving vehicle. They never say what vehicle it is. And if every single one of those, or even disproportionately, was a particular type of vehicle, you know, it was a site dumper, for example, then that's where we should, you know, absolutely focus the attention on. But if it's all by delivery lorries, people who are not used to being on site and not aware of them, and site dumpers never hit anyone, then maybe we don't need to have the same sort of precautions with some machines as others. I mean,
well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, hit by a moving vehicle really does cover an awfully wide range of possibilities, doesn't it? I should imagine that slewing excavators are pretty hazardous, because, you know, you can be standing behind one or alongside one, turn round, and all of a sudden there's a bucket swinging round towards you and you don't see it. So,
yes, yes.
You know, I would have thought that, and there are also another thing with slewing equipment is a possibility of crushing injuries. Those are quite common, though not as quite as common as these impact injuries. I don't know, but it's a good point you make. I think that, you know, there might be some pieces of equipment out there which, you know, really aren't that dangerous, and others which are doing all the damage.
And not unheard of in the plant world, a frighteningly prevalent accident is people in an open-top dumper, and there's been a big push towards covered dumpers, we've talked about in previous episodes, you know, cabbed dumpers, but in an open-top little site dumper, driving up a spoil heap to tip, you know, to add more spoil onto a heap, and going up too steep, rolling over and being crushed, or rolling down a bank and being crushed by your own vehicle.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, solutions to being crushed by your own vehicle underneath the dump truck you're driving is a whole different kettle of fish to being struck by something you're not. You know, if you're a pedestrian outside of a vehicle, and whether it's a delivery truck or a slewing excavator that clips you, is a whole different thing. And the stats don't tell us, I don't think, at least I haven't seen published stats on this, which of those two things are the, you know, crushing, hitting,
yeah,
hurt by a vehicle.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think some people seem to take a very sort of cavalier approach to their own safety. I mean, YouTube is absolutely full of videos of people doing stupid things on construction sites. And very often they're doing, you know, the injuries which presumably result from some of these activities are self-inflicted. They're not, you know, it's not somebody else doing it.
And still the managers get the blame.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, you've got to control these idiots, haven't you?
Yes, but it's not always possible.
Well, should we move on to another? Nice. There's a very, very interesting story which you've been digging into. In fact, it's a bit of a rabbit hole, but I found this quite interesting.
Well, okay, let's go to the background of it. This is, and the headline on the story is, Albanian prefab factory gets order for 10,000 houses, which is, wow, that's quite a big deal. If Ilka or Legal & General had got that, they would have been, yeah, they'd been laughing. Yeah.
Thing is, you say it's Albanian, but it's a British company. That's the thing.
British company, yes, who's got a factory in Albania. There's a company called Eco Buildings, who are listed on the alternative investment market of the London Stock Exchange. Eco Buildings was about a year ago, I think, taken over in a reverse, well, it's a reverse takeover, Fox Marble. Fox Marble is another British company, which had, at the time, I think, four quarries in Kosovo and maybe one in North Macedonia, but the Balkans. And it extracts marble from quarries and finishes it and, you know, selling worktops or whatever, marble products it sells. And they took over Eco Buildings and took the name of Eco Buildings to create Eco Buildings Group Limited. And neither companies are particularly huge, but Fox Marble had some had a former tarmac building materials chief executive as a non-executive director, another non-executive director from a guy who's also on the board of Marshalls and Shepherd Building.
Oh, right, okay.
So there's some sort of, you know, credibility there. I don't think either of those people are on the board of Eco Buildings anymore, but they've been involved there. But both these companies were relatively small in the grand scheme of things. And Eco Buildings has a factory in Albania that makes something called glass fiber reinforced gypsum, which is not a product I'm familiar with. It says glass fiber reinforced gypsum panels, I should say. So basically, it's taking the gypsum waste from these Kosovan mines, and in Albania they're making it wet or with whatever liquid and putting in your fiberglass and making, yeah, these panels out of it. Anyway, Eco Buildings put out a stock exchange announcement on the 19th of November last week, saying that they had secured a letter of intent from the Dominican Republic for 10,000 houses, a value of $237 million, which is, by my calculation, about 190 million of our British pounds. Now, that's a lot of houses for not much money.
Yeah.
even allowing for the fact that there's, you know, got to be local assembly and shipping and ground preparation and, you know, fitting out the houses. It just seemed to be, is this the answer to the UK housing crisis, glass fiber reinforced gypsum panelled houses? I did a bit of a Google, and I'm not quite convinced. You're better on building materials than I am, but I'm not convinced how good a material this is for our climate. It seems to be something more for indoor panelling rather than outdoor walls and roofs and so on.
Well, that's what I would have thought. I mean, when I think of gypsum panels, I think of plasterboard. I think most people do. And of course, plasterboard is not an exterior product. You use that indoors. But I think, I mean, there is a video. I don't know if it's actually an Eco Buildings video, but I did see a video of these panels being made. And it's quite, I'm always fascinated when I see these production lines and see how these products are actually being made. It is quite interesting that, you know, that they lay down a layer. It's basically liquid gypsum. And then they put fibers in it. Literally, they drop these fibers in to reinforce it. But these are sort of, I think they're sort of cellular panels. They're not solid panels. They're probably about, I don't know, 100 millimeters thick, but they've got voids in them. So they're sort of cellular. So they would probably be quite good from the point of view of, I would say, from an energy performance, but obviously they're not going to meet Part L. I don't know. Interior partitions, yes, I can see that. Whether or not, but I think here in the Dominican Republic, they're actually building the exterior walls with them. I don't know. That's a question. But the thing is that I think they might work in the Dominican Republic, which of course is in the Caribbean. Not so sure they'd work in the UK climate.
Well, they in the statement they said that the this is where the story gets interesting. We ran our piece, and within 24 hours, I had received a letter from the Ministry of Housing and Buildings from the Dominican Republic, saying regarding your report, we're reaching out to exercise the right to reply to clarify and rectify some of the information disseminated. Now, this is nothing that I directly had got. There's nothing wrong. It was their gripe was with what Eco Buildings Group had said in their statement, and I'd reported what Eco Buildings Group had stated. Eco Buildings had said that they'd signed this letter of intent following a visit from the Minister of Housing, the Dominican Republic Minister of Housing, who came over, and he saw what they were doing and said, this visit reinforced the Dominican Republic government's confidence in Eco Buildings as a strategic partner for delivering affordable, sustainable housing solutions. This is Eco Buildings in their press statement. Following the visit, detailed negotiations have progressed positively, building on the letter of intent signed with Grama Constructora, a large private construction company in the Dominican Republic. And he goes on to talk about the letter of intent. It will lead to this big deal subject to regulatory approvals.
Yeah.
And the minister was particularly concerned that it made it sound like he was somehow involved in a commercial transaction. And he's saying, no, he was there just to on a fact-finding mission, just to see what this is all about. And the ministry, in their letter to me, said, his visit to the company had the sole purpose of learning about and evaluating from a technical and practical perspective the construction method used by the company.
Because isn't he the a aim civil was to engineer, explore, this chap?
He also happens to be a civil engineer, yes. I don't know whether he had any in his previous professional life connections with any of the companies concerned. I don't know. And they say that the construction company has categorically denied having any contact with the Dominican government for the purchase of affordable housing from Eco Buildings. In other words, yes, we were there, but we weren't part of this deal.
Right.
And to you know, paint us as part of it. And I thought, they're very sensitive about that. British ministers, when they help oil the wheel of commerce, they'll send out a press release saying, look what we've done.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, even trying to claim credit, like the Department for Education trying to claim credit for NHBC training centres being set up. They're trying to claim credit for that. They would try to claim credit for 10,000 low-cost houses that, you know, are coming to East End of London because we've done this great deal with this Albanian factory. Aren't we great, even though it's nothing to do with the government? Whereas in the Dominican Republic, they're so sensitive to accusations of corruption, saying, nope, we weren't involved in this, not involved. It says, An interesting difference there.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the order was from Grama Constructora, was it? Not from the actual government.
So correct.
It's a commercial, yes. Private commercial deal.
It's private commercial order.
Yeah. But I wonder if Grama Constructora has a contract with the government to deliver these homes, or if they're private, is an entirely private venture.
Well, they say the contractor has categorically denied having established any contact with the government for the purchase of affordable housing. So
yeah, you'd think that'd be something to shout about. You know, we've got 10,000 affordable homes coming to the Dominican Republic. You'd think that would be a feather in the government's cap.
Yes, I mean, you look at someone like Homes England; its entire business model is picking winners and say, you know, which private company should we give government money to and get involved with, and you know, decides who wins and who loses. Obviously, in the in Central America, in the Caribbean, it's a different story.
Apparently so. I mean, I've never heard of eco, but eco building sounds like a very generic sort of name, but I've never encountered them before. And although they, as you say, they're AIM listed and are they based in London? Certainly, they're based
offices.
In,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I
mean, if you look at their accounts are nothing to. I mean, Fox Marble, who are they reversed into them.
Yes.
Last figures I found were 2020. They made a £2.8 million loss on £700,000 turnover. I don't think eco building are particularly any big. But if this deal comes off,
yes,
that'll put them on the map. I don't think this deal will. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Ministry of Housing in the Dominican Republic, after these articles have heard, have gone to Grama Constructora and said, "Don't you dare."
No, I don't think eco buildings are active in the UK as a supplier. They might import some. Oh, well, Fox Marble might. I think I had a look at their website and it looks as if their products are available in the UK. But am I right in thinking that eco buildings has already sold some of their panels to a client in Chile? There was some mention of Chile.
I think they've passed type approvals. I'm not sure they've been actual sales, but they've jumped over regulatory hurdles in Chile, I think, is all that they've at this stage. But is glass fibre reinforced gypsum the future? It's good use of waste.
I've never encountered it before. I mean, I think it sounds like one of these modern methods of construction. Whether or not it's got a role in the UK housing sector, I don't know. They do. I mean, the company says that its products are up to 50% cheaper, 2/3 lighter and 5 times faster to build than conventional homes. That's, you know, that all sounds good. Whether or not the homes are, as I said earlier, whether or not they're suitable for the UK climate, I very much doubt.
Well, if you can buy a house for 20 grand or the frame of a house for 20 grand, that's got a certain appeal. Might not get a mortgage on it, but you can always chuck students into it.
Yeah, it could do that. I don't know. Maybe eco buildings can tell us. I mean, obviously, if they can shed some light on this, I think I'd be very interested in finding out more, particularly if they are active in the UK market. But as I say, it's strange that the Dominican Republic, you know, sort of Central America and South America, seem to be the areas they're targeting.
But an order for 10,000 houses.
That's an awful lot.
That would it's a wet dream for the British volumetric builders, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very strange. So, quite an interesting and very unusual story, that one, I thought.
Yes. On the subject of volumetric buildings, I ran a piece this morning, just quick and finally mentioned, I suppose. The Ministry of Housing has published some research which the previous government, when it was the Department for Levelling Up, had commissioned. And it's worth a read. If you go to the Ministry of Housing website, you can find it there, clicking through. Harlow Consulting and Edinburgh Napier University are just raising concerns about, with these factory-built homes, there's no standard fire test methodology which is directly applicable for volumetric construction.
Well, wow.
Testing that takes place is likely to be suboptimal. While there is insufficient evidence to suggest whether a fire is more or less likely in a modular building compared with a traditionally constructed building, the event of a serious fire is likely to result in more serious consequences in a modular building if the choice has been made to use combustible elements in the voids and cavities. I mean, there are a lot of ifs and buts in all of this.
Yes, there are. Yeah.
And I think the telling thing here is that their main conclusion is further research is critical, say research organisations. In other words, give us more money and we'll do more work.
Yeah, I mean, we know post-Grenfell that if you include combustible materials in your building fabric, then that's generally not a good thing to do.
I think the key point is, with all these new building standards and everything, the volumetric side of things has been slightly forgotten about. Anyway, just flag that one up.
Yeah, okay. Well, Phil, have we reached the end? I've been struggling with my microphone issues for the entire hour that we've been talking, so I'm afraid.
Well, I've managed to hear you perfectly fine. I hope everyone else has.
Yeah, so we might have to edit it down to a lot less than an hour.
If they haven't, they've missed out on some really great pearls of wisdom from you, David.
Oh, yeah, bound to have done. Well, look, I'm going to go out and buy myself a new microphone.
Early Christmas present.
Yes, why not?
I think we've only got one of these. Next time we meet, David, I think it'll probably be time for our roundup of the year.
It will, actually, middle of December. Yeah, fortnight from now.
It's early December. I may have, in 2 weeks' time, have decorated the tree. I used to get my Christmas tree about sort of 3 days before Christmas. I think it was lockdown that started, made me think, I'm not spending, particularly the price of real trees these days. You spend, you know, 40, 50, 60, 80 quid on a tree and you want it up for a bit longer. So I think I'll be getting mine sort of the end of the first week in December, a bit earlier.
Yeah, I do that now. Although all my kids have flown the nest, my youngest daughter still comes back at Christmas to organise Christmas. And I'm under strict instructions of when and where to buy the tree. And
she the surveyor?
No, she isn't. No, she's a marine biologist, but she's also a Christmas specialist. Yes. So she's in charge of Christmas and I'm just following orders. I'll be buying a tree about the same time as you.
Right. Well, we'll talk about all things Christmassy and the end of the year and wrap things up, unless something comes to push its way onto the agenda in 2 weeks' time. But for another episode of Reconstruction, from me, Phil Bishop, and him, David Taylor, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.